Major League Baseball today is all about big money.
Sure.
Players signing contracts worth many millions of dollars annually. But it wasn't always thus, was it? I mean, back prior to World War II and around World War II, and even after for a while, players, even big-name players, weren't making a whole lot of money, were they?
Certainly not. I mean, the large portion of the book is really about the fact that you had kind of an indentured servitude. That's really what the players were, locked to their teams. There was no such thing as free agency. They couldn't compare themselves to other players and then use that as a negotiating tool. Basically, they were signed by a team and locked there until the team said, we're selling you or we're getting rid of you, and the players had no recourse. So after the war ended in 1946, you had the situation where the players saw all around them that baseball was incredibly popular. They just fought this war for freedom, essentially, and yet they weren't free, and they had no ability to, you know, kind of use their great skills to get more money out of the owners. So there was a real loggerheads happening where the players wanted to try and get some more money and get greater freedom for themselves, while the owners, of course, wanted to keep the status quo. And much of the off-the-field action in 1946 was this sort of rearguard action by the owners to say, okay, we can't keep things quite as they were, but we're going to do everything we can to keep things in our favor. And they did so by kind of giving in on some small principles for the players and giving them certain freedoms. But the main things, which was the reserve clause, which was the main part of the contract that tied player to team in perpetuity, that stayed for another generation, really, until free agency, as we know it, came about in the 70s.
During the war, during World War II, many hundreds of major league players enlisted in the armed services, most out of patriotic duty. But yeah, you point out there's a couple of occasions where it's becoming peer pressure, right?
Absolutely so. And some of the biggest names, which makes some sense in that they were the ones like a Ted Williams and a Joe DiMaggio who did make the most money and had sort of the most to lose by going off to a war that, you know, they didn't know how long it was going to take, certainly. And you had in 1942, especially, both those players came under severe pressure for not signing up the way a Bob Feller or a Hank Greenberg, who were equivalent superstars, did right away. They kind of had the patriotic urge, whereas Ted and Joe didn't quite have it so much. But, you know, to their credit, they came around and did sign up eventually, and also wound up losing several years of their prime to the war, which in the larger picture hurt them more than anybody else.
There's so many interesting scenarios that you paint in this book.
Thanks.
One in particular, at the end of World War II, after the Germans surrender and the Allies are still occupying Germany, waiting to be shipped back, there's a World Series of sorts being played in Europe, and it involves as many Major League Baseball players as can be drafted, quote-unquote, by the commanding generals.
Exactly.
And they play, they actually play in Nuremberg.
Yes, yes. It's an extraordinary scene, if you can picture it, where you have the very home of the Nazi Party, where Leni Riefenstahl had these, you know, films of Adolf Hitler, you know, at his most crazed, and the Nazis marching around at full strength. Only a few short years later, all of a sudden it was repurposed into a baseball diamond, where you had the national pastime of America being played. And yeah, there was, you know, you had all these soldiers with really nothing to do, heavily armed, and, you know, looking to get into trouble. So wisely, perhaps, the Army, you know, kind of built this huge apparatus of athletics, intramural athletics, and it wound up baseball being the most popular sport, of course, wound up being kind of this point of pride for the various units. And George Patton's Third Army wound up having the best team in Germany, the 71st Division, which was fronted by several major and minor, top minor leaguers. They won the Germany-based competition, and then it was decided to play the best team that was based in France in this quote-unquote World Series, the ETO World Series, the European Theater of Operations. And they had this best-of-five series in the Hitler Youth Stadium, renamed Soldiers Field, and the two teams played each other. And in fact, the team, the 71st Division team that was fronted by all these major leaguers, lost in five games to a kind of a ragtag assemblage of players from a team based in France, which did have a secret weapon, which was two African-American players, Negro League superstars. And it was a very amazing kind of preview of what was just about to come in the United States.
It's ironic, then, that black and white players played together on the same field in Europe before they were allowed to play in the U.S.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which was another a big change that was wrought from World War II in general, is that a lot of black enlisted soldiers you know, went over and fought for freedom around the world, didn't have those same freedoms in the U.S. A lot of things changed when they came back. And, of course, Jackie Robinson, the first black player in the major leagues. My question about Jackie Robinson. Branch Rickey, the Dodgers owner, signs Robinson. Why Robinson? Was he really the best player available in the Negro Leagues at the time? He wasn't, was he?
In terms of pure talent, no, absolutely not. There were several factors, one of which being that he was the most available to be seen by his scouts at the time. Ironically enough, born from a prejudicial event in World War II, Robinson was in the Army. He wound up being court-martialed over an incident where he refused to move to the back of a bus, a military bus. He got off. It was kind of a trumped-up charge, of course, but the incident really soured him on the military in general, and the Army was happy to put the whole thing behind him when Jackie said, I kind of want my release. So he was available in 1945 in the United States to be playing Negro League baseball and be seen by Branch Rickey scouts. That obviously was first and foremost. He was also a very mature player. He was older. He was married, or he was engaged at the time. He was temperamentally difficult in terms of, you know, he had a combative side, but he also was very used to be playing in front of white crowds. He was an all-around athlete at UCLA. He was a well-known name. And it just seemed like he was the kind of guy who would be able to take what it, you know, obviously being the first, the pioneer, the racial pioneer meant, and that meant being under extreme scrutiny, extreme pressure all the time. And he nearly cracked at several stages along the way, but he made it through to the other side, proving Branch Rickey and his scouts correct that he was the one that they were right to pick and not some of the other more talented but more mercurial players that were available at the time.
In 1946, he was in the International League playing for Montreal.
Montreal Royals, that's right.
But they would play American teams.
Yes.
And not without racial incidents at ballparks. Baltimore, I think, yeah. Possibly St. Louis.
Louisville actually was really the worst. The kind of bordering states, Lee mentioned, Baltimore and Louisville were really the two worst. And they were sort of, you know, they were a lot of Jim Crow sentiment, if not outright laws in those cities. And yeah, he faced absolute hardships. The fans would come out of the stands and refuse to let him come out of the dugout. All kinds of, you know, vituperative epithets from the crowd, as you can imagine. His wife was given death threats when she came, his pregnant wife, I should add, Rachel. Black cats were thrown in his path. One time a team in Syracuse actually threatened to come out in blackface. They were all going to wear blackface until their manager wisely put a stop to it. So it was sort of a preview of what was to come in the major leagues, but in some ways it was even worse because it was his first time going through it. It was not quite as in the public eye as it would be in Brooklyn, you know, in the major leagues. And he didn't know for sure whether he could take it. And he got, you know, hit by pitch balls and spiked by players all the time. But he not only did he, you know, survive, but he thrived. Montreal won the AAA World Series, the World Series version in the minor leagues. He was clearly the best player in the league. After the season, his, you know, hardcore racist Mississippi-born manager, who had really questioned his humanity in spring training, shook his hand and said, you're not only a credit to your race, but a credit to baseball, and it's been a pleasure having you on this team. There was nothing but love involved for Robinson after the season. It was quite the transformation in just a few short months.
Stan Musial, hitchhiked to spring training one year. you're driving down the road, and there is one of the best players in baseball with his thumb out.
There's Stan the man. He was heading home, actually, to Denora, Pennsylvania from the war. He had just gotten out of the Navy, and, you know, one of the big kind of subplots or plots of the book is that in 1946 and immediately after the war, the transition back to peacetime was extremely difficult for the country. As you can imagine, millions of servicemen released sort of en masse back into the country. Really, the infrastructure was just not ready for it, and there was a great deal of transportation issues, shortages in housing and of services of all sorts, black markets cropping up for all kinds of goods and services. And one of the reasons, one of the effects of that is that the players, sometimes even great players, Hall of Famers like Stan Musial, couldn't get a bus ride home. So, yeah, there he was getting from Washington, D.C. to Denora out on the side of the road. Didn't hitch up his pants and show his leg. He was recognized a couple of times and given rides. But, yeah, it was tricky. And, you know, it just got worse when the railroads went on strike in the middle of the season, which was the ultimate sort of paralyzing event. And players and teams were stranded all over the country, obviously not just players and teams, but everybody, to the point where President Truman had to step in and threaten to nationalize the railroads to settle it. Otherwise, the country would have shut down.
Just to put things in perspective, compared to today, where you've got players making millions and millions of dollars a year, Stan Musial made $14,000 a year in 1946 playing for the St. Louis Cardinals.
Pretty extraordinary, huh? I mean, even by the standards of the day, he was quite underpaid. Part of the St. Louis Cardinals' operation, their business model, was to have a huge number of minor leagues tied to their team, and they always had a tremendous number of players on hand. And if anybody complained, even somebody like a Stan Musial or an Enos Slaughter, you know, all-time greats, if they started to complain about wanting more money, they could just very easily be shipped off or told to go back to the minors or just cut outright and be replaced by another player coming into the chain. There was always four or five guys in spring training ready to take your job if you kind of talked out of school, so to speak. And it was just, and that was, you know, as we were saying before, that was a big part of the way the owners, especially in St. Louis, kept costs down and kept the players in line.
The reserve clause and basically owning your players for life helped prompt the owner of the Mexican League to think, you know what, we got a lot of disgruntled great ballplayers north of the border. Why don't I hire them to come play in Mexico? And some actually did, didn't
Absolutely
they?
So, yeah. His name was Jorge Pascual. I call him in the book the most interesting man in the world, the original most interesting man in the world. He was a very Hemingway-esque kind of character, fighting in duels and kind of peacocking around Mexico. A tremendous baseball fan, and as you said, he owned the Mexican League, and he had very, very deep pockets. And he saw a market inefficiency is the only way to put it. I mean, all these players, greats and rank and file, who were severely underpaid, and he whipped out his checkbook and lured quite a number of them down to Mexico and really tempted the game superstars, the Ted Williamses and the Stan Musials, to do the same. At the end of the day, they wisely, in retrospect, decided that they didn't want to go out of the country yet again, having just been, you know, through this war, partially, and also because they didn't trust going to Mexico, which turned out to be a smart move given the conditions of play down there. But the point of it was that the owners were terrified by this, you know, by this development, that they realized that all the players had to do was turn around and say, wait a minute, we might not want to go to Mexico, but here's somebody offering us 10 times the paycheck that we're getting now. Clearly our services are worth more than we're getting paid. And that led to sort of, you know, the dawning awakening of the players and the players' rights movements. But as I said before, the owners did manage to fight this rearguard action that kind of put it off for a generation.
So many characteristics of the game back in the 40s are so different than they were even in the 70s, even a generation ago. Barnstorming, for example. Even some of the best players, after the season ended, would go on tours and play baseball for as long as they could, as long as the weather permitted, and just making extra money. Stan Musial among them, right?
Absolutely. It's all about the Benjamins, as they say. Yeah, and, you know, they followed the sun south, you know, into the Latin America, which is a reason why you had the Mexican League sort of, you know, to begin with, fostering, and the players were familiar to them, obviously. And yeah, Jackie Robinson, the day after the World Series, the little World Series ended in 1946, you know, was off on a barnstorming tour. Stan Musial, the day after Game 7 of the 1946 World Series, was off on a barnstorming tour. As he said, he only made $14,000 in the year. He had to, you know, make ends meet, and the way he could do it was by playing baseball as long as he possibly could. Hard as it is to picture, there was also in-season exhibition games throughout the year, which oftentimes the players were given a bit of a cut of by the owners to kind of, you know, another way to smooth over some of the difficulties between labor and management there.
Well, let's talk about the end of the season.
Yeah.
1946, really a turning point in American baseball history. Among other things that 46 is remembered for is that you had the first ever pennant playoff series. Something we all look forward to now, but in those days there were no divisions in the leagues. So, in the National League, if the Cardinals playing the Brooklyn Dodgers in a three-game playoff because they tied at the end of the season,
absolutely.
What strikes me as odd is that okay, the Red Sox run away with it in the American League; they win by several games. But while the National League playoffs are going on, the owner of the Red Sox decides, "Hey, let's just have some exhibition games between the end of the season and the start of the World Series at Fenway Park." And I'm thinking, what is he thinking? And it sort of backfires on him too, doesn't it?
To a large degree, it backfired on him, yeah. Well, what he was thinking was twofold. A, let's get some more money where the opportunity is, as all owners do. And B, it was sort of the classic, you know, Rust versus playing right on through that teams face when they clinch a division early, even today. You know, because of this playoff that was unexpected in the National League, the American League had been almost 10 days before the start of the World Series, so their Sox were afraid, oh, we're going to lie around and lose our edge. So they decided to play some games in Fenway Park, a bitterly cold Fenway Park, I should add, and brought in an American League All-Star assemblage to play against them. And, yeah, it blew up in their faces right away when their superstar Ted Williams was hit by a pitch on the eve of the World Series in an exhibition game and hit on his elbow, a goose egg blowing up to twice its normal size. And he was clearly affected by it during the World Series, in which he had a terrible seven games and in some ways cost the Red Sox, who were heavy favorites in the series, that championship. And the kind of, as you mentioned, a turning point in baseball history, that really was the beginning of the quote-unquote curse of the Red Sox. The Red Sox had never lost a World Series to that point and were assumed to be a great postseason team. And it all kind of came apart right there.
The superstars of the Cardinals and the Red Sox, Stan Musial and Ted Williams respectively, really couldn't be more different as far as their personality. Stan Musial, you paint as a friendly, always smiling, easygoing guy. Ted Williams, not so much.
Cantankerous, I guess, is probably the best word to describe him. Ted was an artistic genius in a lot of ways. Hitting was, you know, his canvas, his painting. Anything that got in between him and his at-bats was not just a distraction, but an irritation. And that included his teammates, the fans who wanted to worship him so badly, but he just didn't have time for them, the press more than anything else. And it was a real kind of a way of approaching the game that kind of, you know, turned a lot of people off. And Stan was, of course, the exact opposite. Hail fellow, well met, always had time for just about anybody who came to shake his hand, loved to do magic tricks and tell stories and just chat away on the train. And another interesting point is that I get to in the book is that at the time, whereas today Ted Williams is really thought of as a far better player than Stan, both greats, but Ted is, you know, the top two or three, Stan maybe in the top 10 or 15. At the time, that wasn't the case. Stan was really thought of as being the better player, certainly a better all-around player, if not a better hitter. And that kind of changed after their retirements, in large part because of the veneration of World War II and military service, and because Ted Williams lost 4 years, not just to World War II, but also to Korea, where he flew combat missions. Stan, you know, he lost 1 year where he had a kind of cushy gig in Pearl Harbor driving a water taxi. So, you know, that really helped to kind of push Ted in front of Stan in a lot of ways in terms of popular public memories, how great they were. It's really kind of an unusual situation, but certainly they were both, you know, all-time greats, and the fact that they met in a World Series where neither played well, kind of a disappointment, but kind of interesting at the same time.
And that World Series, really, a scriptwriter couldn't have come up with a better end to a more important season than the 1946 World Series. It comes down to the seventh game, where Johnny Pesky, a great player, hesitates to throw out Country Slaughter, who's running toward home with a go-ahead run in the seventh game, late in the game. It haunts Pesky for years, doesn't it?
To his very recent death, I'm afraid. Yeah, it did. I mean, and unfairly in a lot of ways. To set the scene, there was one man on first, Country Slaughter, as you mentioned, two outs, bottom of the eighth inning in a tie game. Harry Walker, a player who actually played in that European Theater of Operations World Series that we were talking about earlier, had come back to his normal team, the St. Louis Cardinals, and was in the real World Series. And here he was up with two outs. And he lifted a soft single to left center field, kind of an innocuous hit. And Country Slaughter saw it differently. He saw it as an opportunity to shock the world, really, and he never stopped running around second and around third and came all the way home. Pesky took the relay throw, and in a moment of shock, just like everybody else in the ballpark was shocked, but just a split second, hesitated. And in that hesitation was born several decades of, you know, curse-ridden angst, basically. I mean, he really had very little chance, even if he hadn't hesitated, to throw out Slaughter, who was a very fast base runner and really just took everybody by surprise. But in that double clutch that he took and also a poor throw home, Slaughter scored the winning run. As it turned out, the Cardinals won the World Series and the Red Sox disappeared into their decades-long futility in terms of winning series in ever more painful ways. And because of that, that moment took on added heft. Had the Red Sox won a series in 1967, as they were very close to doing, or 1975 or 1986, Johnny Pesky would have been off the hook long before. But as it turned out, it didn't happen until 2004 when he finally got to breathe a sigh of relief.
Ted Williams, you write, wept openly in the locker room after the Red Sox lost Game 7 of the 46 World Series and then was seen weeping again on the train back to Boston. That's something I never really would have known. And a lot of us kids never really saw the human side, if you will, of a ball player. But that scene that you describe is really touching, given the fact that Ted Williams' personality was really not like that.
Yeah, absolutely not.
Not that human.
Well, and I think part of that is the personality that he, you know, decided to put on display versus his personal side that, you know, was certainly more human than he was given credit for. But, you know, he definitely was a competitive, ultra-competitive player. Imagine how he would have felt if he had realized at the time that that would have been his only crack at the World Series. You know, you can only imagine how distraught he would have been. I think part of the reason, and as well, that he wept so openly was his personal failure in the games to come through. And, you know, he said this was finally his chance to shut everybody up, to kind of get a leg up on his antagonists, especially in the press. And it was such an extraordinary chance to just, you know, cement his legacy and his reputation. And the fact that he didn't come through and that Boston had blown a World Series that was there for the taking was just overwhelming for him. And, you know, he let it all out, not just in the locker room, in the privacy of the locker room, as you say, but openly on a train with fans on the other side of the window kind of wanting to taunt him, but kind of stopping at the time because of the naked emotion that was in front of them.
I looked upon Google the 1946 World Series, and I was struck by this fact. Three of the seven games in the 46 World Series lasted under 2 hours. What does that say?
Well, that tells you a whole bunch about how the game has changed and where the money is coming from, which in large measure is from television revenue. Television was not a factor, of course, in 1946. There were no three-minute breaks in between every half inning. As well, there was not the sort of dig me for the camera kind of stylings in the batter's box and on the pitcher's mound. Pitchers got the ball and threw it right away. Players hit the ball or didn't, ran as hard as they could. Boom, next batter. Let's keep going. Let's go. Keep it going. The thought in 1946 that a modern baseball game, you know, if a fan came into the future and had to sit through your average 3.5-hour Yankees-Red Sox game, they would just, you know, die of boredom. They couldn't imagine this. Why on earth would you possibly sit in your seat for that long, you know, when games, you know, a 2.5-hour game was considered a marathon at the time. And, you know, certainly that's not a change for the better. It's something that we all have to live with, and that's where the money's coming from. So, you know, you pay the piper and you dance to his tune. But I was certainly struck by that as well and wished longingly for a return to that portion of the good old days, at least.
Robert Weintraub is the author of The Victory Season, The End of World War II, and The Birth of Baseball's Golden Age. Rob, thanks.
Oh, anytime, Steve. Thanks so much.